Okay, thanks for listening to the latest episode here of the Dan Time Podcast, where, as you know, we take a tour across the Daniverse. And as I was just telling tonight's guest, I have a real appreciation for independent artists, and they've really made this show what it is. And I drive around, I listen to all the music that I've promoted on this show, and this is no different. This is episode number 100, so I really wanted to cue up a really hot artist, somebody that is doing things differently, kind of has maybe you could say a chip on the shoulder, and is, he's talked about resilience, and this is just a really positive guest with some just a fantastic record here for a debut. And I want to say this from the start, the music on this album that we'll be talking about in this conversation, these songs feel like, at least to me, that you've known them in your head for many, many years, or maybe from another lifetime. They have that quality to them. But without further ado, I'd like to welcome from the greater Philadelphia area, and more specifically, West Grove, Mr. Dan Orlando. Dan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing excellent, Dan. It's great to be with you. Congratulations on episode 100.
Thank you. I was starting to say I never thought I'd get here, but honestly, that would be a lie because I always thought I'd be here. I didn't know how, but I was never going to hit stop once I hit play. And I feel like you kind of had a similar mindset.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I remember a very specific memory that you just triggered from college. We had Wynton Marsalis come to give a clinic, and he said, you know, as you all continue to embark on this journey as artists, just remember that you will struggle. Struggle is inevitable. Struggle is the force that yields diamonds or stones, and you should all be prepared to struggle in every facet of this journey, not just the cliche financially, but emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, physically, logistically, in so many different ways. The struggle is truly the biggest gift of an artistic journey. And if you look at anyone who you may epitomize in the space of being an artist, I'm sure that there is a struggle that feeds their journey and motivates them to continue to push forward and express themselves. And that most of those artists, and I would put myself in this category too, it's not necessarily like they feel that they have a choice. It's almost like this life chose them and it calls to them, and it almost becomes a vocation where you really do yourself and those around you a disservice if you don't chase it down to the ends of the earth and do whatever is necessary to keep yourself in the mix and keep creating regardless of what goes wrong and what adversity happens. And I think that message early on in my life really helped me prepare for what was to come, which was a lot of that, but at least it wasn't surprising. You know, I had heard from one of the greatest performers and artists of his generation ever that struggle was inevitable. You will struggle. Not you might, not there's a chance you might. You're going to. You're heading headfirst into a storm, so be prepared.
Great stuff, Dan, and so true. The older you get, folks, that's going to become very apparent to you, and it's how you handle it. You can hang around those folks who always say, oh, I'm always a day late, dollar short, and you'd probably agree with this advice. Stay away. And some of these might be family members, but as you can, get away from those people who do not pivot around the obstacles. They just kind of wallow in it.
But sure.
Dan, you had a really good, I kind of want to quote or paraphrase a YouTube reel when you're talking about the Heritage Trail and the concept for the record. And you said, it was a really difficult time in my life. I was fighting for my professional and creative freedom. You were having people all around you telling you that you'd never be free to put out your own music because of this deal that went sour when you were in your 20s. And you said, you know, I'm sure a lot of indie artists can relate to this. that's when you got to actually push more. You got to step on the gas. And I'd just love to hear you speak to that a little bit, because I read that and I almost got goosebumps because I thought, yes, it's just, that's one of those moments where you're like, he gets it. And this stuff happens to everybody. It's how you respond.
Of course. So absolutely. I feel that this project is a statement of redemption. And the reason I say that is because it's an amalgamation of things that I had written at the time with a collaborator out of Brooklyn named Kelsey Pierce, who I wrote the lead single Music in My Head with, combined with songs that had been sitting dormant and in a very in-between kind of place where they didn't really have a path to release because of a bad record deal. So, and not just a bad record deal, but also an unserious partner. I guess the main takeaway is it's not the deal that you sign, it's the person you sign it with. It's the people and the environment that you choose to partner with. You know, I looked at this deal and on paper, it was a pretty good deal, especially as an independent artist. It set myself up to kind of make a splash, you know, through the back door, because it financed a lot of what independent artists are looking to finance from the beginning, which is marketing. They had a lot of built-in infrastructure and talent that was able to be there and help me develop in a low-pressure environment. And, you know, between that and also putting a band together and exploring my artistic self, I got what I needed to get out of it from an experiential standpoint. But from a career progress standpoint, I really stalled because it was kind of an all-in-one situation where I didn't have any one particular person advocating for me. And by the time I found that person, it had already become apparent that the partnership had really soured, and I just saw no serious path forward, which ended up having me spend the next 3.5 to 4 years in the litigation process and trying to extricate and fight for, you know, the previous partner to recognize the contractual obligations that they had broken, and so on and so forth. So artistically, what I was deriving from all of that was I had finally come to a place where I had earned that freedom, you know, or as much freedom and distance from that situation as I could hope to achieve. I had earned that, you know, with the help of people like my manager at the time and my family, of course, and everyone else that stuck with me and helped me to rally and form new relationships, particularly in the greater New York area, which we'll touch on in a little bit. But I guess what I want to speak to that is you don't really know how valuable your independence, your creative freedom, your ability to maneuver without interference is until it's gone. So, you know, every deal and situation is different. I can't just create a blanket solution or an anecdote for any one particular person to follow, because you have to follow your heart. And, you know, at the time I wanted to do that deal and I wanted to take a chance. I wanted to take a risk, and it did lead me to a beautiful place in my life. So, you know, life also happens for you, not necessarily to you. However, I had felt really burdened by this struggle for a long time. So I wanted this album to, number one, have a path to release and not tie it up in any other particular arrangement. So that was from a technical standpoint. And from an artistic spiritual standpoint, I really just wanted to channel how it felt to be free again. I wanted a piano pop record that derived on some of my older school influences, but also felt like it was made in the year that it was made. And that's really important. And, you know, so partnering with Ben Jackson and Steve Cook in Nashville for this endeavor was really clutch. They did a wonderful job, and they brought out a lot of different layers in my artistry that I don't have access to, you know, as far as like producing. Or, you know, just creating all of that. Because, you know, being the artist and the co-writer, that's enough of a challenge in and of itself. But I think Ben in particular, as the lead producer, but also as a drummer, you hear a lot of the really deft and intricate blending of drum machine versus real drums with, you know, great parts. Everything is very supportive and feeds into the emotion of the song. So I feel like we achieved that. And, you know, now that that record has had an opportunity to be out there and matriculate and help me build an audience, it's so freeing. It's so freeing to, you know, live in a world where, like, at least in my own universe, there's something that's out there that people can access that I can represent on a nightly basis on stage, start doing band showcases, start directing people towards that. And now, Dan, to be honest with you, you know, my philosophy is I want to build an audience on the strength of my releases and my shows. I want to create a level of momentum for my artistry. And I think in this environment, it's almost better to go slow and build the kind of momentum that opens up opportunities that you can't necessarily foresee now, but they may present themselves, rather than just saying, well, I need to gun for a licensing deal with one of the big three majors, or I got to get a publishing deal so I can funnel this. Yeah, all of that's fine. You know, that could present itself, but not in a vacuum, and certainly not at the expense of creating and writing and kind of doing a self audit of what's working and what's not. And also not being afraid to be in a room where people challenge you. People tell you, you know, this song may need another section. This vocal, I'm not really feeling this emotionally. Collaborating. If you feel like you've had a great song, but it's kind of sitting at the 40, 50 yard line, see if you can partner up with somebody and, you know, they can help you find the rest of that voice and the rest of that story that you might have been missing.
I love that what you said right there, the collaboration part, because I feel like there's definitely some independent artists who they're very proud of their work, but when you listen to some songs, it's not always a dead giveaway, but sometimes you can hear parts and you're thinking, okay, I don't think there was another set of eyes on this. I don't think, or another set of ears on this. It's not bad, but it's not great. And I love what you said there about having that collaborative spirit.
Well, think about it from a statistical standpoint, right? Every one person has a finite but very valuable set of experiences and perspective, and a different network of people and memories and the way in which they think about things and the way in which they create and the way in which they manifest the message that they want to express. So just by partnering with somebody else, you give your art access to a whole different spectrum of perspective, and all of those strengths and weaknesses combine. You can leave this in the actual episode, but I'm like double parked by a meter, and I've had three people come and like, are you leaving? Are you leaving? You know, the, are you leaving crowd? Like, yeah, no, I'm not leaving. Like I'm taking a call. Leave me one.
Oh, and for my listeners, Dan has been gracious enough. He's got a show to perform tonight at the Slow Hand in Westchester, PA. And cannot tell you how much I appreciate you jumping through some hoops here to
on the show. I'm threading the needle because I respect the love and appreciation that you're bringing towards our name, Dan, which I don't know if this is historically accurate, but it's what I've heard. At least the biblical interpretation of Daniel is God is my judge.
That's
a poetic way of saying, I don't really care what anybody else thinks about me. So just by virtue of us being named Dan, we automatically get to give a finger to the rest of the world, and we didn't even realize it.
I'm on board.
Our parents blessed us with an eternal spiritual compass.
Yes. Dan, going back to what I said at the top of the episode, these songs, they feel or they sound complete. They sound finished. They sound like they belong in 2023, 2024, even 2025, but they also... And I know that before we get too deep in the episode, you actually perform with a trio from the classic Billy Joel era, those early records, Turnstiles, The Stranger, 52nd Street. I don't know if you're currently doing that, but
absolutely,
people might be able to hear some of the influence, but Dan Orlando is not a carbon copy of Billy Joel. But I love Dan. Like I said, these songs, they just sound appropriate for the now, and you're going bold with kind of positioning the piano vocalist at the forefront again. To me, it feels like it's been missing. It's not like nobody does it anymore, but the way you do it, I'm all over this record, Dan. I'm not just saying that because we're fellow Dans,
Thank you. Yeah, well, I do feel like there is a closed highway that if someone can access it, there is an appetite for another Piano Man. And I've always chased that ambition, and I haven't been shy about it. I think I'm the next Piano Man. And the reason I say that is because Billy Joel is an artist and somebody that I'll be chasing for the rest of my life. But in the process of doing that, I haven't always focused too much like the carrot and the stick kind of deal. And I tell musicians this all the time, like, just by virtue of loving that music and that artist, there's going to be enough of an influence on you that it's really important to diversify your skill sets and your ears as often as possible so that you can bring a different, evolved, next generation type of flavor to what you're doing in that space. So, of course, Billy Joel's going to influence my piano playing to the extent that I'm doing pop constructs, but it doesn't mean that along the way I didn't discover great bands like Keane or Coldplay or Jamiroquai or Rufus Wainwright or John Legend, especially, you know, the first couple of albums. The list goes on. Regina Spektor, I think, is somebody who really creatively deploys the piano in a way that you haven't really heard before. Ben Folds. So there's been a lot of artists that have done it their own way. However, with the immense, like, as much amount of respect as possible to everyone I just mentioned, it's the hardest nut to crack in this industry is the singer-songwriter at the very, very top. And so, you know, for Billy Joel to have done that as often as he did it, a lot of it involved taking risks. A lot of it involved partnering with great producers like Phil Ramone. So where I can borrow from the playbook, I do, and I'm not shy about it. And you just mentioned playing with his original band. So I'm going to try to keep this the condensed version, but when I was living in the Hudson Valley, New York, my manager at the time, we had set up a showcase in the fall of 2016 in the city to spite my label because we had just entered our, like, dispute era, if you will. And so we did it, even though they warned us, like, don't do it. And then they didn't really say or what. But I was like, well, we already planned the showcase, so, you know, we're going off with it. And she was able to hire Richie Cannata, who is the great saxophone player from all those early Billy Joel records. He's the soloist from New York State of Mind, Scenes from an Italian Restaurant, It's Still Rock and Roll to Me, Only the Good Die Young, Big Shot, Moving Out. All those horns that you hear that laid the groundwork for the Billy Joel sound that we know today, that's Richie Cannata. So he led a horn section on this showcase, and we immediately clicked. And he then looked after me as a mentor, somebody that called me on a regular basis because, in his words, you know, we need young people that are really playing music and leading bands and trying to do this the right way. And he never, like, lost touch with me. A couple years later, he and I were both at Bernie Williams' birthday party. Bernie's a former New York Yankee, great, and now a very impressive guitar player who I've had the fortune of being his music director and band member for also like the last 6 years. So he was a mutual friend. It was all kind of connected in the same scene, right? And that night at Bernie's birthday party, he set up a jam session where Richie and I got to play together for a couple of hours, and that's when he said, you know, I want to invite you to audition for my band. Our lead singer is starting to branch out, do his own thing, so the spot may be open. And I auditioned, and at the time, you know, between the record dispute, my living situation was very odd. I was all over the place. I had a lot of baggage that was not easy to circumvent. And Richie did it anyway, and he fought for me to have this gig. And so now I've been their lead singer for the past 5.5 years. The trio is, for your audience, is Richie Cannata, Liberty DeVito, who was Billy Joel's drummer from the beginning all the way up to the River of Dreams record, and Russell Javers, who did about a 10-year stint with him on the road and on all the records as well, playing guitar. And so the cosmic sort of strange part of all of this is that rather than the goal being I got to be on a stage with Billy Joel or, you know, opening, like, because I was trying to fight my way out of a deal and these guys were sort of fighting for people to recognize their reputation and what they meant to the Billy Joel sound. It's not really an aggressive fight, but it's like you mentioned, a chip on their shoulder. They have one too. And we brought that out of each other. You know, I'm angling to be the next piano man, and these guys backed him up and made the sound what it is, along with Phil Ramone. That's the Billy Joel sound that took him to a completely different stratosphere and thus that band. And so to sit in with those guys and feel that sensation and play that book and see what it does to people, I think was sort of the last dragon that I needed to slay, so that when you and I have a conversation like this and I tell you I'm going to be the next piano man, I can back it up.
Oh my gosh. I'm just like ready to jump out of my chair right now, Dan. I love this stuff. People might hear that as bravado. I'm okay with that. If you think about the moniker, because there's only one, the piano man, Billy Joel. If you take piano out of that, it's the man. And I think people, right, yeah, maybe in this day and age, are just afraid to say, I want to be the guy. I want to be the man. I want to go out there and crush it. And everything I'm hearing from you is just oozing that ambition. But Dan, I wanted to, I forgot to mention, if you talk to Richie, and I don't know if he probably remembers this guy, but I had Dan King from Gloucester, Massachusetts. He collaborated with David Brown that was on maybe one record there with that trio. He was on Glass Houses through Stormfront.
Yes, David, he's on Brown, a number of things. And we just lost David Brown a little while ago. So, but that's really neat. I will mention Dan King to Richie the next time we chat, probably in the next day or two. We talk a lot.
But I wanted to also focus on these songs a little bit and the ones that really stood out to me. Joshua Baca, if I'm pronouncing that right. I listened to that episode or watched some of that episode on the Resilient Insights podcast where you talked about Out of the Blue being a real standout for you. I was telling you the other day when we were emailing about Need to Hear You Say It. I think that's still my favorite. Great overriding theme on this album, Dan, is it's kind of a narrative, maybe tapping into the past, coming back to the present, getting people to remember those memories. The second song, First Love, or First Loves. Mm-hmm. I like some of the audience engagement, percussion and clapping, and especially with First Loves, I wrote in my notes here, it gets you on your feet immediately. Great flow to this album. I like in present day, I like an LP versus a string of singles for 2 years before we get the album patched together. I know that's kind of how things are. It's just little snack size bites for the masses. Not against that.
I'm the same way. I'm the same way, Dan. I think a body of work is really important, and I really appreciate the kind words. And I know, yes, you mentioned Need You Hear You Say It was one that you really liked and favored. And so that would be an example of a song that I wrote while I was in Florida, under the pretenses of that deal that didn't really go south. But again, there were a lot of things that went right. They just never really made it to market. My collaborator on that is Jason Pennock. He's a great writer. He was mostly an LA guy, and then he and I linked up in Florida, in St. Pete. So we wrote a number of songs that are going to come out over the next couple of cycles or so. And I tend to partner and gravitate with great lyricists, but I usually end up bringing the core message first. And then a lyricist kind of helps me figure it out in a way where the prose is as strong as the melody and arrangement that I'm bringing to the table. I think a lot of times, at least in my experience anyway, there's so much training and time that you have to put into getting your instrument ready. And I'm a chord guy. That's really what I love about writing the most. I love finding chords and melodies and harmonic rhythm that speaks to people. I love kind of studying and utilizing performances and settings of the movement of chords and whether they're minor or major, when they happen upon next to each other, and the different vibes that creates without the words really being prominent yet. So like an example I would use is like a Need to Hear You Say It. I think the harmonic rhythm is pretty slow up front because, you know, I wanted to kind of lay the groundwork and tell the story. And so that's when the lyricist comes in with a lot of different details and You know, we work them out together, and then the harmonic rhythm progresses, the chords happen faster as the chorus starts to pick up on a lot of tension and the bridge comes through. So in that particular one, I'm proud of the fact that everything kind of works together, you know, the chords and the rhythms and the drum machines and the eventual breadth of the track give way to the release of a lot of tension, where I'm really just trying to tell somebody that I have feelings for them and that, you know, I would love to hear them say it too. That we had been through enough together and we had really been vulnerable enough with each other that it was almost like, well, what are you waiting for?
Right.
You know? But you know, everybody comes to that stage in a relationship where you're either going to take the next step or you're going to step down. It doesn't always necessarily mean a ring or marriage or a house or a kid or anything like that. It's just that crossing into that serious plane. And so, you know, to look back on that song and that memory and that time in my life, it's fascinating. And it also, like I told you, it feels good that it's out and we can talk about it. We can share it. That was one in particular that had, you know, really no pathway to market, and it was a struggle. So, you know, that one I look favorably on too, only because I go, wow, you know, it really made it. First Love, same thing, same collaborator on both of those songs.
Dan, I love, also, and need to hear you say it, the drums. I think there's a kick drum that starts to appear, but not in the very beginning. And it's about a minute and a half before the full drums come into play. And I'm a sucker for that kind of stuff.
Right, right. Yeah, that was Ben's call. He did a great job with what he calls scene changes. So he's very particular about keeping the listener engaged and knowing that the song needs to grow and experience, like he said, scene changes and different movements and layers of listening so that you can continue to pique the interest while also not taking away from the emotional connectivity, which he really preached was the most important part of getting this record done, which was tapping into the emotional center and figuring out, you know, what it took to help people connect with the song. And, you know, in his mind, and I agree and share this philosophy as well, that's priorities 1 through 10. And then 11 through 100 are everything from, like, who likes the first mix to, you know, what order does the album go in. But the first 10 priorities are the emotional connection to the song and the performance of the song.
First Loves, I had a comment there. I like this. Or no, I'm sorry. Tell me what you're thinking. I wrote in my notes here, it's real, real playful. That's the word I wrote down. And I love, tell me where your mind goes, uh-oh, that technique, if you call it that, it's probably a better way to say it.
Uh-huh.
But this record, yeah, I drive around and listen to music. That's mostly how I do. And it's usually when we're driving or maybe people are going for a run. It's when your mind opens up. And some of this stuff is for the here and now, and some of it, for me, I'm a little bit older. It takes me back to those relationships that were stuck between love and lust. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember that one. You don't want to go back there, but it's you do get to a point in life where it's fun to reflect back.
Absolutely. And it's important, especially for artists.
And right before the next to last song is just you and piano, Why Do I Run? Is that one of the Florida songs or is that a past couple years?
I appreciate the question. That's more the past couple years. And the inspiration for it was I was kind of going for a blend of Bob Dylan and Gabe Dixon, who's another great artist that I don't think people talk about enough. Wonderful piano player and vocalist. Really just sizzles on record and on stage. He's phenomenal. And so he, I think, has really come up with a lot of ways to Travis pick on a piano, you know, where like you would hear a guitarist oscillate amongst the strings and create a wall of sound.
Uh-huh.
Gabe Dixon, in my mind, really, he came up with a lot of really neat ways to do that on our instrument. And so that was the musical template and the groundwork I was going for. But that was one I wrote by myself, and I just kind of treated it like a journal entry or, you know, maybe if you were like sitting with a therapist and trying to figure out why so many well-meaning situations in my life had just completely fallen apart. You know, were they built on a house of cards? Did I not see around corners that I should have seen? And I was having a conversation with my mother, and she's a real yogi, loves to meditate, loves to reflect in a beautiful way. And she mentioned something about pattern interrupting. When you get to a point in your life where you can take a couple of steps back and do a 360 view and go, what is it that I keep doing that limits the life that I want to live? You know, what is it that maybe I keep perpetuating? And I guess from my standpoint, I don't know how fair I was being, but I just allowed myself to have a moment of like, well, then why do I run? You know, were there situations where I could have fought harder or wrangled things differently? But then, you know, Dan, that's not life either. So, you know, you only know what you know at the time. You don't have the benefit of hindsight. You can't go through a wormhole and be 36 when you're 26 or 26 when you're 16. You just have to grow up and take all of this as it comes. And so that song is really just an open kind of window into my sadness, but also my relief and the peace that I'm trying to make with how my life has transpired and ways that which it could have been different, or ways in which should I have stayed and fought, or should I have fled? And at least with that song, you know, I make a peace with it. So that's also, it was a very deliberate choice for it to be solo and for Ben to kind of surround it with some different textures. And then lyrically, I just wanted the audience and my fans to understand what my takeaways were and be with me in a moment that was sorrowful, but also reflect. And maybe from this moment on, I'm not going to run anymore. I'm going to fight for the life that I want. I'm going to advocate for the life that I want. And whatever or whoever is in my way, I'm going to either work through them or around them. And whoever is by my side, I'm taking them with me.
Terrific stuff, Dan. I love every bit of that. Wanted to throw this out here too. Joshua Baca said it best on his podcast. People asking him, who is this Dan Orlando guy? And why is his album so good? I mean, I was just stunned with how great it is. And it's not globally just smashing through the boundaries or whatever, but it's just puts you in a good place. Wow. Well, I know we're running short on time, but a couple other quotes I wrote down here from you. I would be useless doing anything else. I love that one. I'm so glad you're not doing anything else. And always thinking about music. I think you've also described yourself as, hey, look, the music, I can't get away from it. I'm always thinking about melodies and hooks, and try as I might, this is me. So
always, yes. Music was an easier mode of expression for me as a child than it was to speak. So, and I didn't discover I had perfect pitch until about like I was 10 or 11, but I started memorizing keys of songs and then correlating them to keys on the piano and keys as a whole. And then, you know, fast forward, sometimes I can't shut up. I'm quiet at first, but then you get me going and it's, you know, someone has to walk out with the cane or the wrap it up box from Chappelle's show, you know. And
well, on Dan so, time, but you can always get going on here.
Exactly. Exactly right. Exactly right. But no, it's been a pleasure to revisit some of these memories, to talk about this album with you. And again, you know, congratulations on your 100th episode. And I'm really honored that I was the guest to mark this milestone. I do have to run so that I can go get paid.
Yes.
but really, Dan, thank you for having me on and your thoughtful and considerate questions and the time that you spent with the project. It really shows. And I hope we can talk again soon.
Absolutely, Dan. Well, everybody, anything I didn't mention bio-wise, you'll see it in the show notes. Go to danorlandojr.com. Dan, if they want to follow you on social media.
Yes, at Dan Orlando Jr. on social media. That's me.
Okay, and if you're in the greater Philadelphia area this summer, this fall, Go check him out. You can see his performance schedule on the website. And before we leave, Dan, congratulations. I did see you got a baby girl coming in September.
Thank you so much. Yes, we sure do. My wife and I are thrilled, and mom and baby are healthy and on the path. So that's all we want. I pray every day for that. And thank you for your well wishes in that regard. I appreciate it.
Wonderful stuff. Great talking to you today. Let's reconnect in the future when you have some more material or something else to promote. I'd love to have you back on.
I would love that, Dan. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, that's it for episode number 100 of the Dan Time Podcast. Dan Orlando, check him out. The album's called Heritage Trail, and you can find it wherever you discover new music.